The crimes, the criminals, why did they do it? Who got hurt? Did they meet justice or commit the perfect crime? You'll find all the clues at Jim Harold's Crime Scene. Welcome to The Crime Scene. I am Jim Harold. So glad to be with you once again. And I think this has the potential to be the most fascinating episode we've done thus far in the 20-something episodes. I know I've been doing podcasts for the last 6 years, and I've got to say I'm extremely excited about tonight's program just because it's such a fascinating topic, and one that I'm guessing is a little bit misrepresented in the TV and the movies that we get to see. So we're going to get it right from an expert. I'm talking about Gary Noesner. He is the author of Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. Now, Gary retired from the FBI in 2003 after a 30-year career as an investigator, instructor, and negotiator. Now, a significant focus of his career was directed towards investigating Middle East hijackings in which American citizens were victimized. In addition, he was an FBI negotiator for 23 years of his career, spending the last 10 as the chief negotiator for the FBI, so he worked in many hostage situations. He retired as chief of the FBI's crisis negotiation unit, and just a fascinating career. And following his retirement, he became a senior vice president with Control Risks, an international risk consultancy, and most recently spent 5.5 years working on a kidnap case involving 3 American defense contractors taken hostage in Colombia. Well, Gary Noesner, welcome to The Crime Scene. We're very honored to have you on the program, sir.
Thanks, Jim. It's a pleasure to be here with you tonight.
So I must ask you, and I do want to get into your career and so forth. How misrepresented, though, is this whole idea of hostage negotiator? What we see, you know, I think it was Kevin Spacey that had the one movie, The Negotiator, and we see these different TV and movie representations. How far off base are they?
Well, I think typically you see a characterization that has a negotiator acting sort of unilaterally and shooting from the hip and sort of being a very manipulative, conniving kind of individual. And in reality, it's a team approach. And the actual voice for the team is the primary negotiator, and the essential skill set that we use rather than manipulation is just honest, open, above board. Hey, I'm here to help you get out of this situation. It's relationship building that enables you to exert some influence.
Now, I have to imagine when you started with the FBI, a 30-year career, if my math is correct, probably in the early 70s, probably the area of hostage negotiation was very underdeveloped, I'm guessing. Can you talk about your start with the FBI and how you came into this this burgeoning field?
Yeah, when I first got into the FBI, the field really didn't exist. And then as I was getting through new agents training school, we had a seminar where we talked about various new evolving approaches the FBI was taking and this new concept called hostage negotiation, which had been really borrowed and copied from New York City Police Department. The FBI was just beginning its journey in this program, and hearing about it and made me quite intrigued, and made a mental note to myself that this was an aspect of training that I wanted to get into when I had an opportunity. So about 5 years later, when I had a sufficient seniority, I was able to get a slot in the training program. And as you said, the rest is history.
Now, in terms of the approach of the negotiator, you know, a lot of times we see kind of this almost paramilitary thought that we're going to go in guns blazing and we're going to take them out. How does that differ with the approach, the negotiation approach, which I'm assuming is the one that you prefer?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that was the prevailing notion in law enforcement, dating to the advent of negotiations and in essence, being paramilitary organizations. Law enforcement is charged with enforcing the law and arresting criminals, and when confronting someone who refused to cooperate and threatened the lives of others, police would show very little patience in dealing with them. And often after asking them to come out and getting a refusal, they would go right to the force card right away and attempt to gain compliance through the use and exercise of force. That, of course, resulted in a lot of unfortunate consequences, including the death of police officers and hostages and of course, perpetrators. So negotiations was a process that evolved to contain the situation, to use verbal skills to attempt to diffuse and de-escalate the situation and convince the hostage taker that there was really nothing to be gained by threatening the lives of hostages and they weren't going to accomplish their goals, and bring them to a point where they could think a little bit more logically and clearly about the consequences of what they were doing. And by the way, significant success was achieved.
Now you think about the contrast with something like Branch Davidian and the situation there.
Yes, and I was involved in Waco and for the first half of it. And what we had there was not so much a manifestation of the older approach. We had a non-scene commander, and there were elements within the FBI that certainly wanted to take a firmer approach with the Davidians and, in essence, force them to comply. And of course, ending up the negotiation team, we were able to try to resist that as much as we could, knowing full well that the more we pushed, the more likely we would get resistance. And there were no hostages inside. They were people who were aligned with David Koresh and fervently believed in him. So they were where they wanted to be. So in essence, their demand of the FBI was go away and leave us alone. And we couldn't do that because of the deaths of the ATF officers that had triggered the event. So it was a very, very big challenge in not only negotiating with, David Koresh and all of his issues, but trying to convince on-scene commanders and others that we had to take a more intelligent and thoughtful approach to dealing with these folks.
Getting inside the head of a hostage taker, that seems like it would be a very specialized skill, that just not anybody can do it. Is it empathy that's the key point there? What are some of the key components into getting inside the mind of somebody that does something this, evil and stupid?
Well, I mean, you see the full range, and I think the first thing you have to understand is not every hostage taker or every barricaded individual or suicidal individual is the same. They all have different motivations and different behaviors that are being manifested, and it's not so much getting into their mind, but it is making an attempt to understand how they feel about a given situation and to acknowledge that and, in essence, demonstrate empathy, understanding. That is quite different from agreeing with what they're doing or becoming overly friendly or insincere. You just say, I can understand how you would be upset at having lost your job or, having learned that your wife had an affair, whatever the motivating issue is that has brought the police in the confrontation, and a demonstration from a law enforcement negotiator that they appreciate the challenges and difficulties the person's dealing with helps to create some rapport, and ultimately that often leads, and most often does lead to the ability to exert some influence over what this person does and getting them to think about other alternatives, away from the tunnel vision of self-destructive behavior.
Have you talked to people who have done this that you sense at their core they're actually good people, but something pushed them over the edge?
Well, that happens to a lot of people. In fact, a relatively small percentage, probably 10%, are just hardened criminals who are trapped in a bank or on an airplane or whatever it might be. Most of the cases that law enforcement negotiators respond to are individuals who are manifesting their anger, rage, and frustration. They're engaged in often self-destructive activity for which they seem to have no way of getting out of. They've exploded with rage based on some challenge in life, personal, employment-wise or otherwise, and now they've done something that they now just don't know how to get out of. So those are the big challenges, to kind of diffuse that anger and frustration And those are the most dangerous cases. Excuse me.
What, and again, I'm sure it differs from case to case, but when you're not talking about a hardened terrorist who is doing this for a cause, mm-hmm. or you're not talking about that hardened criminal who's been cornered in a bank during an armed robbery, but if you're talking about kind of this average person gone wrong, is there a triggering event? What sets these people off in your experience?
Well, you just mentioned that there typically is a triggering event which has occurred in the preceding 24 hours. Not always. Sometimes these are an explosive manifestations of something that's been building up for a while. And often we see the most dangerous situations are based on relationships, romantic relationships that have gone badly. And these are the cases where the ex-boyfriend or husband comes into the workplace and, you know, is contemplating killing the girlfriend or the wife or whatever it might be, and oftentimes do. Those are the toughest cases because that person is in essence out of control, and their emotional equilibrium is out of sync, and it's quite a challenge to restore that.
Now, another question I would have here. Has there been a trend? It just seems, watching the media, that there has been, but maybe this is just, you know, we see the worst news reports. But it seems like there used to be more hostage-taking situations without any bloodletting. And now it seems that more people, quote, go postal and actually start going into a place and pulling the trigger. Is that just a perception based on what we see in the media, or is that true?
Well, I think we're talking about two very different events. I would say that there is a growing number of cases where someone, quote unquote, goes postal, and based on their anger and frustration, their accessibility to weapons, their inability to have appropriate coping mechanisms, they resort to violence against an employer or a spouse, someone that has, in their judgment, mistreated them or abused them in some fashion. So yeah, we see that as something that is increasing. But in terms of violence that results from someone personally taking a hostage, not so much. There's always been a pretty low violent result out of a pure hostage situation. When someone takes a hostage, it's a very specific goal in mind. They need a hostage to try to force the authorities to do what they can't do on their own. Their goal is to have their demand met, so they feel empowered by threatening the life of a hostage. And when the negotiation team, the police department, shows up, slowly and systematically, the individual comes to realize that they don't have as much power and control over the situation, and they're, at the end of the day, left with two alternatives: is either cooperate with the police or resist and face possible serious consequences, including the use of deadly force against them. So if you accept the premise that most hostage takers want to live more than they want to die, that's why we're very successful in resolving hostage situations. In contrast, this much higher percentage of emotionally driven situations are the ones where reckless and self-destructive behavior sometimes prevails despite excellent negotiations.
One thing that has always fascinated me when seeing this, or, you know, extending to areas beyond the scope of our discussion, bank robberies or those kind of things, but hostage situations specifically.
I'm sorry. I didn't know if you'd ask. Go ahead.
No. In terms of hostage situations specifically, it has always fascinated me that someone believes that they can do this and get whatever they've wanted. I've never understood that, because I'm not that familiar with that many cases where it's had that kind of outcome. I mean, maybe there are some somewhere where somebody got what they wanted and got away with it, but I would think those are very few and far between. So to ask, I mean, obviously these people, when they do this, are somewhat unbalanced and are not thinking clearly, because the chances of reaching that goal are minuscule. I've never understood the psychology of it.
Well, I'm not saying that doesn't take place, but here would be your typical scenario, that someone goes into a bank to rob the bank and get money. They trigger the alarm, the police show up, and now they're trapped in the bank. So that individual who came in to get money and not die now attempts to use hostages for two purposes, to keep the police from coming in and to try to press for his, usually his, sometimes her demands to get a getaway car and money and so forth and so on. Understanding what their motivation is really gives us a lot of power as negotiators, because we realize this person is not there to throw their life away. And in most all of these cases, they come to their senses and they surrender and they comply. So that's sort of a good news. There's not too many people that say, well, today I'm going to go take a hostage downtown and I'm going to demand $10 million and they're going to give it to me and I'm going to get away. So many of these acts sort of evolve spontaneously more than they are a planned hostage-taking event. Now, obviously, Hollywood often portrays that the other way, and they get it wrong.
Maybe that's the reason for my misunderstanding, and that's why we have you on the program. Now, do you have a story of a situation where, boy, it looked like it was going to end in a bloodbath, it was not going to be a good outcome, and you were able to come on the scene and turn it around, and you even surprised yourself that it worked out? Do you have any scenarios like that?
Well, in the first chapter of my book, you know, Stalling for Time, there is a case I talk about that I was involved in the mid-80s, where a man was holding his former common law wife and child. He'd kidnapped them in Connecticut and ended up being holed up and found in a farmhouse in Virginia. And, you know, he had no clear demand. He really didn't know what he wanted other than he wanted them, although his former wife wanted nothing to do with him and had made that clear. So the situation became very tense, and when I was negotiating with him over the course of many, many hours, he eventually worked himself up to a frenzy and was very close to killing her. And to try to stop him, I asked him if there was anything I could do to keep him from killing her. I'm downstairs in a farmhouse, and they're upstairs in the bedroom. And she finally said, "Can you get us out of here?" And then he responded before I could, saying, "We want to go to that helicopter." There was a helicopter out on the farm field, the FBI helicopter. And so now that was good news to me, because I had an opportunity to work with him on something that he wanted and needed, and to basically detract him away from his countdown to kill her. So that was like hitting the lottery. And eventually I was able to convince him to come out of the house and go to the helicopter. In this case, I'd like to say he peacefully surrendered, but in this case he didn't. He came out of the house with the child tied to his back, a five-year-old boy, and his wife, former wife, very close in front of him with a gun to her back. And eventually an FBI sniper marksman was able to take his life in order to save the woman and child. It's not the typical way we end these situations, and not the way we like to end them, but sometimes a negotiator has to do that, as well as achieve the high 90% of success that we normally do with no injury.
I know you've also worked in the situation of prison riots. Now, that would be interesting, because it would seem like it would be, I mean, human nature is human nature, but maybe a different psychology, because they're prisoners and they're convicts. I would think in some ways they'd be a little more skeptical and harder to deal with.
Yeah, I think that's quite true. One of the challenges, there's some benefits and challenges in a prison. The benefits are it's not easy for them to get out, and so it's fairly easy for us to control the situation. But on the flip side of that, it's also difficult for us to get in, based on the nature of how prisons are built. We also tend to have good information and psychological histories and criminal histories about the inmates readily at hand. So there's some pros and cons. But what you are dealing with very often in prisons, a very tough population of individuals, and ones who have often used violence as their primary coping mechanism as they've interacted with society. And so it's a very challenging case. But we also find that they very often end up having a fairly realistic sense of what they can accomplish. They seem to relish in tearing the prison apart and seeking revenge on snitches or others who they don't like. But at the end of the day, they want to return to that routine of prison life and regular meals and exercise and being able to make a phone call or whatever it is that they do. So it's almost a matter of exercising some patience to get them through this initial euphoria of being in control and dictating, you know, how they move about the facility, and ultimately getting them to a point where they realize that, okay, we've had our fun, and now we're going to have to come to some common sense agreement to get this resolved. That's, I've been involved in 3 or 4 of them. They've all ended basically that same way. In essence, what we agreed to do on day one is what they agreed to accept on day 8. They just weren't ready early on.
Now, I have to ask this, and I kind of think I know what the answer is, but that's why I ask the questions. Obviously, you have to keep a professional distance from these people that you negotiate with. But has there ever been one, or maybe more than one, that you've taken a personal interest after the fact and followed up to see how they turned out? Because, in some cases, I would assume that there's probably maybe not agreement with what they did, but maybe some sympathy in certain cases. Has that ever been the case, or basically your involvement's done when the situation comes to an end?
Well, there's not a lot of long-term follow-up, but there are a few cases. In the book, I mentioned the Montana Freeman incident that lasted 85 days out in Montana back in 1996, and we were able to achieve a peaceful surrender from this anti-government group. And one of the leaders was, in essence, a pretty good guy, a farmer who had made some bad decisions and got involved in this anti-government group. And I developed, I think, a rather positive relationship with him, negotiating with him, and we have been in touch, subsequent to the end of this situation. In fact, I was in friendly contact with him when I wrote the book. So occasionally you do have a relationship, a special relationship that's built, but that's not always the case. I think a negotiator has the same emotional feelings as anybody else. You just learn to control it. It's a bit like a surgeon, a trauma surgeon, right. Surgeon controlling their emotions when they're in the operating room and some horrific accident victim comes in and they just get right to the work of doing what they can to save this life and patch this person up, and they try to put their emotions aside. And I think in many respects, a negotiator is analogous to that.
So in the last 30, 40 years, if you talk about where things were when you started and where they are now, how do you feel about that? How satisfied are you with the progress that's come in this field?
Well, that's a very good question, and no one's asked me that just that way before, and it's a complex answer I have to give you, because we have learned so much in terms of our collective knowledge as a negotiation profession. But the challenge remains in getting decision makers in law enforcement to fully understand and appreciate what we do. In other words, we've taken many steps forward, but there is from time to time been some steps taken backwards where law enforcement officials at the state, local, and federal level, you still hear about poorly managed situations. It's certainly not the norm, but it does happen from time to time where, because of a lack of education and understanding and appreciation of what a negotiation team does, people can try to use that force option and to make entries to arrest someone when they'd be better off staying outside negotiating. So these sorts of things continue to happen. So I basically come to the conclusion that despite all that we have learned and the advancements in this business, there's a lot of continuing work that needs to be done.
It sounds like there needs to be not only, of course, progress at the FBI level, but as you said, local and state agencies need to have more people with these skills.
Well, I think that's it. I think historically, again, I mentioned earlier that law enforcement agencies are comfortable with the use of force, particularly in the United States, and police officers are trained to identify a problem and solve the problem and to act decisively and to take charge and to do those sorts of things that restore peace and order. And that's often a very black and white kind of issue. Whereas negotiations has sort of it's a gray area for people. You know, it's a soft science, as they say. And not everyone in the business, particularly even at the administrative levels and decision-making command levels, are comfortable with that. There's also what we call the action imperative in law enforcement. You also see this in military and the government. There's often a compelling need to be seen as being decisive, to right. be seen as taking some action to address whatever the problem might be. And oftentimes that action is counterproductive and it's not well thought out. So these are things that, as negotiators, we constantly have to strive to work towards achieving a better understanding of what we do and why we do it.
It sounds like it can be, in some case, almost a systemic ego thing.
Well, sometimes it is. Sometimes it's ignorance. Sometimes it's, well, I have a better way. And I mentioned earlier, in Waco, we had some decision-making command authority that said, hey, you know, the best way to deal with these people is to tighten the noose, to put ever-increasing pressure on them, to, in essence, force them to do our bidding, to make them come out, and not really appreciating very well the psychological aspect of the knowledge that often the harder we push, the more likely we are to get resistance. It's the paradox of power. So I always used to tell the negotiators who worked for me that dealing with the perpetrator was far easier than dealing with the command decision makers, who often have their own ideas and want to be seen as decisive and can often undertake initiatives that are counterproductive to the negotiation process.
I'm going to ask you a question. I don't know if it's a fair question, so if you don't want to answer it, you certainly don't have to.
Sure.
If anybody ever finds themselves, though, in a situation where they're confronted with a mm-hmm. violent person, and mm-hmm. I guess it differs by situation, do you offer any advice to them?
Well, if you're talking about if someone's a hostage, it's a little bit different scenario than if you're just saying, how do you respond to a violent person? If someone's physically attacking you, you obviously have to try to defend yourself, and you should. But if it's a verbal attack, and it's an argument, you know, you fall back to the thing we all learned in school. It takes two to argue. So Rudyard Kipling said it best, if you can keep your head about you when all else are losing theirs. I mean, if you can respond to someone who's angry and frustrated and agitated in a calm way, that can be infectious. It can help to calm them down. It can help to restore their equilibrium. And it can avoid violence. There's no guarantee that will work in every instance, but it's typically the best approach to take. If you respond by verbally attacking that person in kind, it only serves to ratchet up the hostility and to put fuel to the flame of anger and frustration. So, you know, we have a saying in negotiations about self-control, that the only aspect of one of these events that you can totally control is your own emotions and your own behavior. And if you can keep a control of yourself, you're far more likely to achieve the positive outcome and influence the other person the way you want.
Well, I will say it's been a fascinating discussion. I do want to end on two things. The final
sure.
thing, I want you to tell us where we can get the book and find out more about your work. But before that, we started out talking about negotiators in the media, how they're portrayed in TV and movies. And now that we've had this discussion, when next time we turn on our television or go to the cinema and see a movie where there's a hostage negotiator, what would you want us to keep in mind about real life?
Well, I think the nature of Hollywood, the movies and television, is they have to have a protagonist. They have to create a hero, and the hero has to be smart and heroic, so forth and so on. And if this particular script has a negotiation angle to it, this person will take on, you know, very significant individual powers of understanding and persuasion and manipulation. And I understand why Hollywood does that. In reality, all really good negotiations basically boil down to a primary negotiator being very closely supported by three or four other negotiators. It's a team effort. So, and it's also a process. And people need to understand that it takes time, and we can't just go in a situation and say to somebody, you're engaged in self-destructive behavior, sir, you're acting foolishly, stop it, because you know you're not going to get what you've asked for here. We can't really approach it that way. We have to earn the right to be of influence. And that takes some time, and obviously that time requirement, and that's where I got the name of my book, Stalling for Time, that time requirement just can't happen with a snap of a finger or a brilliant argument that the negotiator makes. It takes time.
And what are you up to next? Are you are you going to do any more books? I mean, do you do any consulting for TV or movies on how to portray this accurately? What's next for Gary Noesner?
Well, it's kind of all of the above. I mean, I do a fair amount of public speaking, and I'm signed up with some speakers' bureaus. I also speak at law enforcement conferences. I do some kidnap consulting for corporations. And I try not to work too hard at this phase of my life, but I do keep pretty busy as far as another book goes. I have to get my wife over the time and effort that it took to write this one before I let her know that I'm embarking on another. But we'll see. We'll see what the future holds on that.
Well, we thank you for your public service. Where can people go on the net either to find more about you or find your book?
Well, I have a website. It's www.GaryNoesner.com. And through that, there are links to ordering the book. You can do that through Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any of the book vendors. It's on Kindle as well as in hardback. And in the website, we'll list some of my speaking engagements that are open to the public and so forth. So, yeah, I would hope people have an opportunity that are interested to take a look at the book and hopefully will benefit from it. Because I think the lessons that I learned as a law enforcement negotiator have pretty broad applicability to everyday life and how we deal with our employer, our subordinates, our family members, our neighbors, and our friends. You know, if the skill sets work in a desperate, emotionally driven situation where life is on the line, then why shouldn't it work in less critical events?
Well, I've certainly had jobs where I felt like a hostage, so it makes sense to me. Well, thank you so much, Gary Noesner, for coming on The Crime Scene tonight.
Well, thank you, Jim. I appreciate it. Enjoyed the interview.
And everybody, thank you so much for tuning in. I knew this would be a good one. We will catch you next time. Stay tuned. Bye-bye.